Good afternoon and welcome to the Toekomstmakers podcast, literally Future Makers podcast, recorded on the occasion of the 20th anniversary of De Jonge Academie, the early and mid-career chapter of the Royal Dutch Academy of Sciences. We are in the Trippenhuis in Amsterdam with Mayuka Battini and Sarah de Rijken, recording live in a theater with an audience present. My name is Max van Duin. I'm a member of the Young Academy. Our topic today is the PhD, and we will reflect on how it's currently organized and experienced in the Dutch system. PhD candidates are at the heart of academic research and fill around 40% of the total FTEs in research positions. They contribute far beyond their dissertations. They teach, develop learning materials, they mentor, they publish software, collaborate, do science communication, and a lot more. But the traditional PhD trajectory often fails to acknowledge the full breadth of this work. So today we speak about the PhD of the future, a project or movement to change and improve that, to strengthen the connection between PhD research and society. Welcome to you, Mayuka Battini, board member of PNN, the PhD network in the Netherlands, and yourself a PhD candidate at the Netherlands Cancer Institute. And welcome to you, Sarah de Rijken, Dean of the Faculty of Social Sciences at Leiden University, and Professor of Science, Technology and Innovation at the Center for Science and Technology Studies. Mayuka, to start with you, as a PhD candidate, how does it make you feel if someone comes to you and says, hey, we're changing the PhD trajectory, you should engage with society more now?
I would say that I need a much longer PhD for that to happen. Or we need to find ways to make this fit into the four-year contract that is currently standard. And for that, it's really important to value non-traditional research outputs at the same level as traditional outputs, because right now what's most important is papers and publications. But if we really want PhD candidates to go out there, connect with society, then something needs to change. But I also think that now we shouldn't suddenly hold up every research project to the yardstick of whether or not it is immediately relevant to society, because a lot of the most important discoveries in fundamental science were made just because someone wanted to satisfy their curiosity about a certain molecule. But what I believe that we need to do is broaden the definition of research and what we currently think are research outputs. This can be something like science communication, it could be societal engagement, and we need to incentivize PhDs to do this more.
Thank you. So we will get back to this tension, as you maybe phrase it, between, well, some PhD candidates, some topics are more appropriate for this dialogue with society than others. Yeah, we'll get there. But first, the incentive structures. So, Sarah, you're also the chair of the Academia and Motion Steering Group at Leiden University. This is the Open Science and Recognition and Reward Program over there. Yeah? So when you think about the PhD of the future, so what does success look like? Yeah? And how should we assess quality?
Yeah, so I think you already covered some of that ground. So in that program, we combine indeed open science and recognition and reward deliberately. So using the UNESCO recommendation definition of open science, when you do that, it's not only about like fair data, which is also important, but also about what is your question, who's it important for, who is included and excluded in that type of thinking about the start of the work. And that is, I think, also something that you are addressing. So some work has a peer community of your peers, like academic peers, but it can also be broader. So if we think about broadening out what is research, we should also start to talk about what is the broader definition of research quality. And that links back to the purpose of the work. I recently learned a new term, backcasting. I don't know where it's from, media maybe. So you start with the end like in mind, right? So what is the end goal of a PhD project? It's multiple. You also learn to do research. But we can also talk about, okay, the goal of my research is fundamental. my peer community is ABC. The outputs and processes that are relevant are XYZ. And I want to use open science practices, so I'm going to share my data and methods. So these types of processes and outputs then also structure, I think, what is necessary for quality control.
Yeah. So it's now brought up by both of you, yeah? So there is, of course, the side of the incentive structure and how do we organize it such that a dialogue with society or doing other activities than just publishing peer-reviewed papers, that it is recognized and rewarded in the right way. So that's one discussion. But the other discussion is indeed also really about what do I want to achieve with a PhD and does it actually fit for me and my topic to engage in a dialogue with society. So, and Sarah, of course, you have a experience as a supervisor yourself, besides your experience as a dean, but as a supervisor, how do you see this?
I supervise PhD candidates that study the impact of indicators. Impact of indicators, we found, was very fundamental. So not only when you think about publishing somewhere, but from the start, and you mentioned some of the issues already, like the projectification, but through funding logics, getting a paper out there in a certain window of time, ideally in a high impact venue. That is not necessarily a problem per se, because you also talk about, you have fundamental research questions that are genuinely interesting, obviously, but there's also some perverse effects of the system that leave you wanting for time to engage. A lot of people we interviewed said, I didn't start out doing research thinking that society would be somewhere there. I wanted to change something in the world. So there, I think, it's really important that we rethink this thinking with indicators much more fundamentally.
Yeah.
But as a supervisor, that's what you ask. I don't know if there's time. But
yeah, of course. Yeah. But it's interesting. You added yet another level. I thought you, as a level, you added, I've also been a PhD researcher myself. But you meant the other level is the meta research on science incentives and metrics. Yeah. I was interested in your experience as a supervisor yourself and whether, well, you in particular supported them and told them to go out there.
Yes, but then we also hit the system. I have and had a very international group of PhD candidates. So some of them came, for instance, from the UK, and they were used to thinking in journal lists. And they were also anticipating moving back to the UK. So we had very interesting discussions about how can we do both, like think outside of the box when it comes to publishing or other activities, and also help you to move to that other system. And that took a couple of years, so you can't really do that within one trajectory. But from the team point of view, I think it was important that we started to think about helping each other a little bit. So you do co-authorship, you make a bit of room here and there. But we also are still in the system. And they are also very meta, and they also study these dynamics, but they are also PhD candidates that need to move forward. But of course, I wasn't like whipping them to do the... the high impact papers all the time.
And what's interesting, indeed, you did mention that, yes, the next step counts a lot, of course, for PhD students. And here the backcasting, I think, is again relevant. If your aim is to go into a postdoc somewhere internationally, then we can talk long about how we want to change the Dutch system. But then, of course, what we need to align with somehow is the needs for PhD students to still have a CV that fits international expectations. Is that a pressure that you feel, for example, Mayuka, or and you now again? The interesting thing about having the two of you as guests is, of course, that you have all these different perspectives because you are a PhD candidate yourself, but you're also a representative in a network where you, of course, hear a lot of perspectives from other PhD candidates.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's always this pressure to balance what you would personally want versus also having a good CV and also what your supervisor wants, what your group or your department wants. I think for me personally, it's okay because I am I'm more of a fundamental researcher. But as you also said, I also speak on behalf of a network. And there we really find many different perspectives. Some people want to keep it very traditional. Some people want to go out there and do a lot more. Some people get resistance from their group leaders, from their supervisors. Others just have much more supportive groups. Mm. So there are lots of levels of resistance to this. But I think what's really important to remember is that PhD candidates, as you also said, are not isolated. It's not that our project is just ours. It is what contributes to our supervisor and our group leaders' promotions and their growth as well.
Yes.
It's a lot of difficult things to balance.
Yeah, that is, of course, always a complicating factor, that the PIs have their interests. Aligning these with what is actually the interest of the PhD candidates is, of course, a known level. Now, both of you mentioned team science, and it seems that there is an interesting solution here, because if you have a team, you can indeed work on some publications together that go in multiple dissertations, and that frees up some time to do other activities. But it also gives some flexibility on the team level to have individuals do what they're good at. Sarah, is there an experience as a supervisor, but also again as a dean? Do you see teams in your faculty that work that way?
Yes, although I think a really good example of how you then implement that in graduate school format is actually Leiden University Medical Center. They just launched this new protocol. But I think what is very good about that is indeed the recognition of the team effort. But it is really a really progressive example because it does a lot more than that.
It came out indeed a few days ago, and we should link it in the show notes. So
So I think in the Faculty of Social Sciences, not everything will apply, and we also need other things. So it's in a sense still particular output based. We also have anthropologists that do multimodal research, so we also need to include that in the methods and the types of processes and outputs. But I think that goes really a long way also to focus more on preprints, but also learning peer review, and also at the team level think about engagement with society. And I like that it's at a biomedical institution also, because some of the questions that we are really facing for a long time now is some of the, so behind the statements about fundamental research, if we pose it like against each other, fundamental research and societal engagement, I think we run the risk of not touching upon like a fundamental issue in thinking about assessment. And that is that point about indicator logics and projectification and the types of questions you can address also in fundamental research when we have this logic. So that is limiting the scope of research and the types of questions. And that is also applicable to fundamental science. I think it's this restructuring. So that's why I like the example a lot that they set with this at your graduate school level.
Yeah. And indeed, it's also interesting that part of that movement is also that within a four-year PhD trajectory, you don't always have to, say, ask the research question, then set up the data collection, collect the data, and then do the analysis and interpretation yourself, publish on this yourself. Yeah. So the idea is also that you carry a larger project forward, and that whatever you do is then part of your dissertation and is evaluated as your contribution, and then from there others are picking it up. And I think this is also then in the international perspective, of course, one of the pillars in open science. So do you see, Sarah, you've contributed to the UNESCO report on open science, the recommendation. Do you see that this is also internationally changing? Is there indeed room for working this way?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. There's also, it depends on where you look, but our discussion in the Netherlands started, I think, in 2012 here in the KNAW. So science and transition, opening that discussion. But then the discussion was already international. So we had a lot of discussions about research waste, how can we change that also in biomedicine and the behavioral sciences. Looking at where we are now, I think there's a shift in the landscape. So we're definitely not the most progressive country anymore. There's also a lot of other funders globally that are working around more responsible research assessment and open science practices. And we have COARA at the European level. It's difficult, but if you look, take a longer historical view, you see progress.
And it's interesting, of course, because I think PIs often are the ones who say, well, my PhD students need to publish because they want to score a postdoc somewhere. But interestingly, maybe this argument is starting to be less and less solid. What is also connected to this is then how do you evaluate output that is maybe not a peer-reviewed publication. Yeah? So how do dissertations need to change? Mayuka, are you aware, you have the overview, are you aware of people who really include different things than papers in their dissertations already?
I'm aware of a few. So I've been on the hunt for people like this for a while now. And I must say it is much rarer than even I anticipated. But there are some people that are really changing what their dissertation looks like. For instance, I spoke to a couple of people that just wanted to include, who wrote some code, and they wanted to just include a vignette alone without it becoming an article just in their thesis because, well, they wrote it. It's not per se, traditional. It's not a traditional research article, but it's still research output. It's still something that they've contributed to science. There are also other people that are including their reflections on developing some educational materials. Again, it's not traditional research output, but it's also their own contribution to the academy. And yeah, they want to make that a chapter. And I don't mean including it as a chapter in an appendix somewhere or as an afterthought after all the research articles. I mean it becoming a main chapter in the thesis. Because if we want to broaden what research means, then we also have to broaden what a dissertation is. And we need to broaden what a PhD committee is. And yeah, it becomes bigger and bigger. But I think we really need to kind of throw out this notion that from project A, we get two papers or three papers that will be published in Nature Science or any of the other high impact journals and that. That's like a thinking.
So if you're listening to this podcast and you know examples, please reach out, send them to us. And indeed, within the Young Academy, we have started this collaboration with you from PNN, but also with the Nationaal Expertise Centrum voor Wetenschap en Samenleving, the NEWS. We also did as a first exercise is look at all the PhD regulations of the knowledge institutions in the Netherlands. And actually we noticed that there's more space than we initially thought. There is actually quite some space. Also to, in not all universities, but some universities, actually possible to include field specialists in your committee. We can also learn a lot from some other disciplines, artistic disciplines, for example, where they have very different ways of evaluating. Also multimodal work, just mentioned by you, Sarah. So I think it's also very important to really look around. And here again, we run into the PIs quite often saying, well, how will this, they often see the limits in their organizational embedding instead of in their own minds. But this then needs a culture change probably rather than just an organizational change.
Can I add
Yes, of course.
So we have, when we started this project, we looked at promotion regulations from a university perspective. But what I really notice is that every department, every faculty has their own regulations. So this becomes a lot more complicated than what is or is not allowed in the central regulations. Because as Sarah also just mentioned, LUMC has now a policy. The question is also, are now the departments and the faculties going to follow what is in the central regulations? Or do we need to change this at every department? Because that is something that I've also heard from several people, from several PhD candidates themselves that I've spoken to. They say that, yeah, sure, it's not strictly necessary from their university, but in their department, this is the expectation. So I would say it's more of a culture change that is necessary than a structure change. Or maybe we either need to unify all of these regulations or we need to dismantle all of them and make it very case specific.
Sarah? Culture change or organizational change?
Yeah, the easy answer is both. Yeah, what I prioritize? Well, culture change, but culture change can't happen without changing the rules explicitly as well. So,
What are the obstacles now in your perspective?
It's fascinating that you did a little bit of research about this. I think a lot is people think that stuff is in the rules, but it's actually not in the rules. So, we have this myth. Esther is nodding, our rector, about four article-based theses in our university.
It's not there.
But I continue to have to say this. And so that's fascinating. There's a lot more room, but there's also this culture, indeed, about having something. I don't know what it is. Something to grasp. Something that people tell each other. So a little bit of security, but it's actually not there.
I think. There's also this perspective on what it is to have a dialogue with society. We think of disseminating results, talking to people about what you found. I think it would be also interesting to open that up a bit more. You can also ask questions in a more inclusive way, or you can engage in the interpretation of your data with societal actors together. Mayuka, again, I look at you because again, in a medical realm, I can totally imagine that this would be standard practice or not.
I would imagine so myself, but it's not. I mean, oftentimes, society, I would say, is the next step. Oftentimes, I also find that there's very little dialogue between medical practitioners, doctors, and researchers. It depends per institute, but I would say it's also not that common for fundamental researchers to speak to the clinic and vice versa. But that's what is really necessary to, to take fundamental research to the clinic.
So there's also the more international perspective. So we've now focused a little bit on the Dutch bubble. But the international perspective is that some very prestigious universities, for example, in the United States, give out the PhD degree, the highest academic degree we have, based on relatively thin dissertations, maybe 100 pages. And the PhD students who produce these, and in that system they're more students than candidates, the PhD candidates or students who produce these have often published, but that's not necessarily reflected in that dissertation that they hand in. So there's already a completely different system of quality assessment in the output.
I think it's an interesting problem. It is, of course, we've also spoken about this a little bit already, that if a PhD candidate wants to then do a postdoc in the US, then how should they build their CV? But I think what is important is giving this choice to the PhD candidates and allowing them to shape their own trajectories. If they want to stay in Dutch academia, that's great. If they also want to go abroad, that's also great. But it's the point is that we need to allow more flexibility to shape this trajectory. And about quality assessments already being very thin, I agree with that because a PhD is not really strictly defined anywhere across the world. I think throughout history, a PhD has been like an apprenticeship to become an independent researcher. At least that's what we believe. But what is an independent researcher or what is an independent academic? Like, that definition is constantly changing. Now, with the recognition rewards movement in Dutch academia, the demands, we've accepted that the demands of academia are no longer the same as they were in the past. And if a PhD is meant to be training to become an assistant professor and move beyond in academia, then maybe we should change what a PhD is training this candidate for, right? We need to start earlier, and that would be my, my take on this.
Do you feel prepared for contributing to academia currently with how it's now organized for you?
No. But it's also hard to envision what my role would be 10 years down the line, I suppose. But not really.
And it also resonates with what you were saying earlier, Sarah, that there is this myth that a PhD, that is for publications. And even if it's not in the PhD regulations per se, that seems to be then a myth pretty much connected to the Dutch bubble, right?
Yeah, it's a good point. I'm tempted to make it even more complex. one of the issues that we're trying to address with recognition and reward is that the minority of PhD candidates will end up in academia in the first place. So what do we train people to become? And that is also a reason why I think it's relevant to broaden out what a PhD trajectory and the assessment of that trajectory looks like.
Yeah, the Rathenau Institute has also worked on this recently, and that's another link for the show notes. But indeed, this is. Thank you for opening up this direction, because indeed, if we think about what contributing to academia is, Maike, you were already saying, well, that's not just publishing papers, obviously. That might be exactly that little bit that is in the interest of the assistant professors or PIs in higher seniority stages, because that's what they need to show for their promotions and for their future grants. Yeah? To make the whole system perpetuate, you need these publications. And the more PhD students you have, the less time you have to write them yourself. So you have, you know, so there's sort of this active construction of that myth. But also, so does it indeed mean that opening this up disadvantages then the assistant professors in particular, because they really sort of are still waiting for that promotion? Sarah.
Maybe a little bit of a qualifying remark, because we also have disciplines in which that doesn't work like that, I think. So that is also a discussion. We also have disciplines with single authors still. I think one of the struggles we're facing indeed is that it's a complex set of issues. So one is indeed the career system that also assistant, associate and full professors are in, and you're dependent on each other. And then there's a power imbalance emerging, and that also relates to social safety issues. So it's all really complex, but I think indeed there's a more fundamental point we need to address, and that is how we do yearly appraisals and promotions large.
All roads lead to recognition and rewards. Yes, there are more questions. Then let's move from there to there. I think there's time for all the hands now raised. Hester, please.
Yeah, system and way we behave. So what is your reflection on that, and how do we go about that?
Thank you. Yeah, let me try to rephrase again, and stop me if I fail to. No. This is actually a very good point, and I will give it to you then, Sarah, if you don't mind. Yeah. So, Sarah, you said I'm going to make it more complex. Well, I will now add another layer of complexity as well, and that layer of complexity is indeed that we can change this maybe on the level of the PhD trajectory and try to change. And maybe it's not wise to make it an obligatory extra thing. Yeah? For sure, there needs to be room to do things differently based on your topic and your personality. But how are the assistant professors and associate professors and full professors who come from this other system that we currently have as the result also, this has emerged in the course of the past decades, but they have been trained in this system, so they probably also won't have the mentoring skills to coach PhDs who would be part of a new system. And similarly, we also don't prepare these PhD candidates who would be then part of the PhD trajectory of the future in our master programs. What is your reflection on that?
I'm tempted to also give a shout out to all the assistants, associate and full professors that are capable of doing this already. They do exist. I know a lot of them. Complementary set of things need to happen. Part of it is culture. Part of it is also changing the rules of the game and acknowledging that takes time. So I've I recognize this issue. We have a gatekeeper issue in the system. So people that are in gatekeeping positions have a huge power to keep things as they are or to affect change. And that requires indeed a lot of activities around them, training, but also the way you select people in those positions. So it doesn't. It's not a pipeline trajectory. There's also people coming out and in. And that is the moment in which you do this type of change as well. That requires a certain rules and regulations and leadership to make the decisions about who becomes an assistant and associate professor in the first place. And I think, funders do a lot of work here too, because the push for change also comes really from them increasingly as well. In the past, that was a negative experience because we had careers that went along the line of ERC grants and NWO grants. But they can also affect positive change in the behavior by setting other criteria that we now need to address, like open science.
Yeah, I think Leiden is lucky to have you in the gatekeeper position as a dean. Yeah.
Can I add to that quickly?
Yes, absolutely.
Short note, I think it's also very important to not put all of this responsibility on the one supervisor that this PhD candidate has. The reason why committees exist is to have multiple perspectives. Right now, it could be that these committees are quite narrow within the same domain that this PI is in or this PhD is in. But one way we could address this is by opening up this committee to people that are also outside the academy or to other people that the PhD candidate personally wants to learn from and be mentored from. So the reins maybe need to be given to the PhD candidate here.
So by opening up, you mean allowing people with different experience
with different
in the committees, but also opening up maybe the time window in which they are active.
Because
now they come into view only at the very, very end.
Yeah.
You're suggesting that this is earlier already.
Later. Yeah. I mean, it's also about having the flexibility. Maybe this committee can be changed. Maybe as the requirements, because we all know that how a PhD trajectory begins is not always the way it ends. Actually, most of the time it's not. So maybe we should also have this flexibility in this committee to also change the people that are involved in it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, but thank you for that perspective. Yeah, okay, yeah. So there are also voices saying that we should not emphasize on opening things up, changing things, because we have seen examples in the past where academia tried this, for example, with narrative CVs or with recognition and rewards itself. There's always the criticism that by putting more emphasis on the possibility to have different roles, we get more and more expectations from people, also people where this doesn't necessarily resonate with. So how do you see this in the context of the PhD trajectory of the future? Should we just become much more liberal or should we try and anchor this in regulations? Mayuka, how do you see this?
I think this is something we've spoken about a little bit already, about there being flexibility and choice. One thing I can think of is in recognition and rewards. Now at several universities, they have many profiles for assistant professors to track systems, I guess, research, impact, leadership. Maybe that could also be possible at a PhD level, where it's okay if someone wants to have their 3 high impact paper, and that's great. And maybe that's a research track. Or maybe if they want to have more societal impact, that's a different track. Then I guess it would then involve a little bit more. This is all things we're speaking about for the future, right? Like, we need to still, of course, think about how this can be implemented. But we need to make sure that the flexibility and the choice is there.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, and this also resonates then indeed, Sarah, with what you were saying about backcasting. So what do you actually want to achieve with your PhD as a PI and as a student? And have that conversation early on and then set the incentives and the structure of the trajectory such that you can actually achieve what you commonly agree on. Thank you. Esther.
I've been in a committee in PhD 3.
And now I wish the microphone had been there, yeah, because sure. This is a no, but this I think is a really important point. And I think so. I think we've covered this in different bits and pieces. But thank you for the reflection, because this is really indeed what we need to take into account for this project as it progresses. Yeah, thank you. So Lenneke, I think, and Noël, and that was it, right? Let's finish this. Or, oh, yes, okay, sorry for missing you. Yes, please, you first. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, so one of the topics where this has for many years been on the radar of university, you know, PIs, policymakers, is the balance between teaching and maybe supervision efforts and time purely reserved for research. Sarah, do you think that promovendi, PhD candidates, should be involved in teaching per se, or should this also be something that they are free to choose in consultation with their supervisors?
Well, that's a quite normative choice, either or. I think so. For my let's keep it a bit simple. For my social science faculty, the situation is that most people in the faculty are involved in teaching in some form or other, and most PhD candidates would also be interested in learning the skills, but if you're on a certain grant, it's rather impossible to do so. And I think increasingly when we think about, in the university context, making equally important in also assessing what we do, education and societal relevance, but also education, we need to think about how then we make space for that in our yearly appraisals, and indeed whether people get actual time for it and the training and get a qualification for it and all these things. So we're, I think, in Leiden also quite far in thinking about, I'm sorry, but also criteria. I think it's very important that we have criteria, that we have something to hold on to. But context counts. So it's always the case in this answer to the question as well. So it probably will be a little bit different in another discipline. But I think having a PhD in social sciences, I think it would be really valuable if we make a lot of space for the development of educational skills and taking that as seriously as possible.
So can we talk a little bit about the role of the funding bodies? Mayuka, do you really think that opening up the PhD trajectory would fly with the funding bodies?
To quote someone else, funding agencies don't fund PhDs, they fund research projects, right? And how we define research projects is what needs to change. I'm not a PI, I don't write grants, but from my limited understanding of how they work, it's not like you need to say that this will result in two papers or three papers. The grant needs certain milestones, and maybe those milestones now could be different. Maybe this will result in a workshop or a video or, it can be anything. And I think the way we need to think about this needs to be a little bit more creative and broad.
Thank you. Yeah. The burden of the final question is on you.
I was thinking about what's the face value of a PhD and what a PhD actually constitutes, setting aside in academia.
So I think this also does come full circle with the first question, and also in a way that we will definitely take into account when furthering the project. I'm not so sure whether we can still reflect on this, or whether you feel that we should leave it with where we stand now. Yeah, would you want to reflect on this? I will do that, absolutely, if you think that we need to answer this beyond what we have covered. Yeah. So I think, Noël, so if then indeed rounding off now for real, yeah? And thank you for your patience. The question is, if we start opening up the PhD trajectory, if we start talking about the dialogue with society more, yes, we should find ways to change the incentive structure, but that automatically also changes what a PhD is, and in the longer run, how people will look at what it means to have obtained a PhD. So maybe we should also think about that differently. Vaguely is referred to as you have the qualification to be an independent researcher. But the evidence for that now is a dissertation. But maybe the evidence should be really the diploma that you get when you finish your PhD.
I guess this makes me think of bachelor's or master's, where the only evidence is a transcript and a diploma, right? Maybe a dissertation, but I don't hear a lot of people going through a master's thesis, for instance, so it could work, but a PhD is supposed to reflect more of someone's individual work than just an educational degree.
Yeah. So you would rather than make what counts as a dissertation more inclusive. It doesn't fully cover your question, Noel, but I think it has been noted for the future. And more generally, the PhD trajectory of the future is something you will hear about more in the future. And with that, I would like to thank you once again and round off. See you downstairs for the bottle and party.